Hey there, this is Ari. Welcome back to the Energy Blueprint Podcast. With me today is someone very special, someone whose work has had an enormous influence on me, on my thinking, and on my paradigm through which I teach about human health and especially energy. And that is Dr. Robert Navio. He is a man who is very hard to wrangle into doing a podcast. I've literally been trying for years to get him to do this. And with the help of a mutual friend, Dr. Eric Gordon, he was able to nudge him a little bit in a way that made this happen. Dr. Robert Navio is a physician and a researcher who runs a lab for mitochondrial medicine at the University of California, San Diego, a place that I've actually had the pleasure of going to. I've gone to his lab. I've had the pleasure of meeting him in person and having a little private session, tutoring session, you could say, on insights into mitochondrial health and the cell danger response. As I just alluded to, he is the scientist and researcher behind the paradigm of the cell danger response, which is, I would say, maybe arguably the single most important piece of research and paper in our generation, as far as health science and our understanding of many different chronic diseases. I know countless experts and practitioners that have been hugely influenced by Dr. Navio's research, myself included. So it has been a distinct honor and privilege to do this podcast episode with Dr. Navio. I think that his work is among the most influential and brilliant work of our generation from any scientist. So with no further ado, I hope you enjoy this podcast with the brilliant, wonderful Dr. Robert Navio. So Dr. Navio, thank you so much. It is really a great honor to have you here. I have been trying to make this happen for many, many years, and I know that you are generally reluctant to do these kinds of things. So I really appreciate it. And as I said to you before starting this recording, I think it's very important for people to hear from sort of the man himself, from such an influential researcher and thinker in this space. I can speak for myself and many others, many other experts that I've interviewed over the last 5 years of doing a podcast, that your work, particularly on the cell danger response, has been really a landmark contribution to this field and our understanding of certainly chronic fatigue and what's going on in many diseases. So again, thank you for doing this. So I know you're short on time, so we'll jump straight in. Can you describe, for people who are unfamiliar with it, what the cell danger response is and why you believe it's central to understanding chronic fatigue and many other diseases?
Sure. The cell danger response is an evolutionarily conserved universal biologic response to environmental stress, threat, infection, or injury. And, it's a normal and reflexive part of life. We need it to learn and adapt. We need it, to give gains after exercise. We also need it to fight infections and heal from injuries and to heal from psychological traumas. So the CDR starts by sensing stress or injury in mitochondria in the cell. And if the threat is slight, like a paper cut or a scrape or a common cold, the CDR is confined to those affected tissues. And if the injury or threat to life is large or infection is severe, as with a heart attack or stroke, Lyme disease, or a SARS-CoV-2 infection, for example, mitochondria and cells trigger a multi-system and multi-layered response that ultimately involves both the brain and body. So, our research has given us a glimpse of, a connection between many chronic illnesses. And when we performed metabolomic analysis of over a dozen different complex disorders, ranging from primary mitochondrial diseases through autism spectrum disorder, myalgic encephalomyopathy and chronic fatigue syndrome, Gulf War illness, depression, suicidal ideation, and ALS, we found that the pathways that were dysregulated by the cell danger response are a common denominator in each. And since we know that genes and environmental risk factors that cause these disorders are actually different in different patients with the same disease, it got us thinking that it's not the specific pathogenic trigger that creates a specific disease. Instead, it is each chronic disorder is caused by a single shared biological response to over hundreds of different pathogenic triggers. And this common biological response we call the CDR.
What can I ask you, what are some of those triggers?
Well, some of those triggers are, you know, a Borrelia infection in Lyme, an EBV infection, a SARS-CoV-2 infection. It can be a hazardous volatile organic compounds in the workplace. It can be a head trauma. It can be, just anything that causes a stress outside of the normal range of homeostasis ends up triggering, the cell danger response to greater and lesser degrees. Mm-hmm. So, when we started thinking about this, we needed to find a way of integrating, all the strong work that has already occurred that uses what we call the pathogenesis paradigm. And we began to think of causes of disease in two classes. And many different genes and environmental factors can lead to a disease like autism spectrum disorder or, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS. Yet each disorder can be diagnosed by, specific core symptoms. So the causes are different in each patient, but the core symptoms are the same. This led us, to think about this concept of penultimate and ultimate causes. And so the study of penultimate, causes of illness is well known. That is the study of pathogenesis. Pathogenesis is a study of different genes and environmental factors that initiate the injury, trigger the CDR, and start the entry into the healing cycle. In contrast, the study of ultimate causes is the study of the shared biologic response that's used to exit from the dynamic process that maintains chronic illness. That's the study of salogenesis. Pathogenesis creates the injury. Salogenesis affects the repairs. These are distinct pathways, and it's important to remember that the path to healing cannot be traveled by retracing the path that led to the illness.
Can you elaborate on that? What you mean about that last part, that the path to healing is not just the simple reversal of the path to illness?
Yeah. So for example, if we develop a pneumococcal pneumonia, we have a bacterial infection of the lung that can be treated with antibiotics that can eradicate the bacterium. But then there's a lot of damage that's done to the, to the lung tissue that has to be repaired. And, the removing of the bacterium is just the first step, but energy and resources from the body have to be, redirected toward, rebuilding all the broken alveoli and the blood vessels and to reestablish the architecture of the lung. So that's one example. And, we could talk about, head traumas and traumatic brain injuries. Frequently when an injury has occurred, it has a, this long lasting effect that, just knowing what the original cause was, doesn't actually help you to resolve the chronic symptoms. Mm-hmm.
So you said the ultimate causes of disease, you described it as things that, I'm sort of paraphrasing here, but things that prevent salugenesis, things that block the healing cycle.
Yes.
What's going on there? How would you describe that, or what kinds of things prevent the body from entering the healing cycle or completing it?
Well, sometimes it can be a secondary infection. Sometimes it's helpful to, you know, think of these in the simplest terms. So if you have a cut and it's partially, you know, healed, but then you stretch it over a hand and break it open again, the healing process has to start, go back to the beginning. It has to start again. It can't just, you know, pick up where it left off. Same thing if you remove a scab from a scraped knee, it goes back to the beginning. The same thing happens, and it's actually been measured in the crashes in chronic fatigue syndrome, is that you can, you know, go from one state of metabolism to a state that's more dependent on glycolysis and more inflammatory, that's, after a crash, that then requires you to make your way back to your baseline after the crash. So I guess the important thing to remember is that re-injury can, you know, keep you in the healing cycle. But sometimes what happens is the cells that initiated the signals of danger and threat that triggered the initial cell danger response, and the brain that is responding to sensory information sent from those cells haven't yet been convinced that the world is safe enough to heal yet, and so, you know, it keeps the signals going that maintain defense even when the actual triggers are in fact gone.
I know I sent you a list of questions I wanted to ask you for this interview prior to it. I want to jump a little bit ahead because I feel it's a natural segue with where we at where we're at in this conversation. So just going further on salutogenesis, do you feel that this concept that you're describing as far as the healing cycle has been incorporated or properly incorporated into the conventional medical paradigm, the Western medical paradigm?
Not at all. In fact, you know, our training in the scientific method and in Western medicine has really focused on the things that have been successful up to now, okay, which is, you know, in Western thinking, typically isolate a single variable in doing your experiments, listen with your experiments, ask a question of nature, and then listen to the results and design a new experiment. That's very effective when a disease or process is regulated by single things. Okay. But what we find in the vast majority of chronic illness is that they're pluricausal. That means, you know, that's a term that was used by Hans Selye, that basically means that, for example, you can take a disorder like ALS, and you can have an SOD mutation that can lead to it. You can have a TDP43 mutation that can lead to it. You know, they almost never happen in the same patient. These are just different things, different ways to get to the same, the same problem. And so ultimately, so we've been taught to think about diseases in a way that has been effective in the past, but is not very effective at understanding dynamical processes. Okay, so and you know, a lot of our inspiration not only comes from fields of ecology and evolutionary biology, and so that led to us thinking about salutogenesis as a dynamic process that has regulators that can, drive outcomes in one direction or another, but are not on and off switches. Okay. What I think of solid genesis as a multi-layered process that starts with mitochondria and cellular changes that ultimately can grow to change whole body behavior and metabolism. And the autonomic and endocrine systems and the microbiome are always engaged, when the CDR is activated. But because solid genesis, healing is energy and resource consuming, you have to actually take materials to heal a broken bone or to recover, from a heart attack, for example, that you can't restore, full and vibrant health without being able to redirect those energy and resources away from cell defense and back to normal cellular functions. So I guess, yeah, so that kind of leads to this natural idea that we talk about pathogenesis-based approaches to medicine. That's filling the this book that has been we've been writing for the past 5,000 years of written history that I call the first book of medicine, that really is based on the pathogenesis paradigm and has been very, very effective for many acute disorders. But I believe that to discover effective treatments for chronic illness, we need a new paradigm and a new way to do medical research for discovery. And I think that study of solid genesis-based treatments and the process of the molecular process of healing will help write the pages of a second book of medicine.
Can I offer an example disease and maybe see how you might think about it differently? And you can feel free to suggest a different one if this one doesn't resonate with you. Let's take heart disease and sort of atherosclerotic heart disease as an example. Again, feel free to change the model if you'd like. And the way that the conventional medical paradigm thinks about this in an oversimplified way is essentially that there are factors in the bloodstream, things off with cholesterol and LDL and oxidized LDL and lipoprotein A, lipoprotein B, and that ultimately these factors are driving this atherosclerotic process. There's factors that are causing endothelial injury to the blood vessel lining, and then you get these LDL, oxidized LDL particles incorporating into the blood vessel wall, driving this disease process. And the typical sort of thinking about this in the standard medical model would be to apply statin drugs. So sort of operating in this pathogenesis model and then applying a drug intervention to interrupt or slow down the development of that atherosclerotic plaque. How might you, from the second book of medicine, how might you think about this differently? Or what layers would you add? And again, feel free to change the disease model if it suits you.
I can work with this. I mean, one of the things that distinguishes coronary artery disease from a lot of the other disorders that's we've studied is that there is objective histopathological structural change. Okay, so a lot of disorders are due to just functional changes in how the cell responds to signaling. And don't have to, lead to structural disorders. But in that case, what we know is that stress leads to inflammation, leads to oxidized cholesterol, lipoprotein particle in lipoprotein particles, and even when studies were done on 20-year-olds. That had been in the stress of battle in Vietnam, coronary artery disease was rampant
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
young men. And so the process of preventing coronary artery disease is something that I think we'll have, we have to address as well. The process of remodeling coronary arteries after, let's say, we have, foamy macrophage changes, and growth of underlying smooth muscle cells, takes a more concerted effort that is still going to start with, being able to provide those cells that are currently working under signals that trigger the the inflammatory or the first phase of the cell danger response, that the danger has gone. Now, you won't be very successful at doing that if, in fact, the people are still fighting a war, okay? Or, they are otherwise engaged in activities that produce a systemic stress response that is chronic. So, ultimately, I don't want to get too far down this line because I know, so far the only way to, we can decrease the rate of, of progression in atherosclerotic coronary artery disease with statins, but we can't reverse it. No study has shown that statins reverse coronary artery disease. However, there can be slow reversal with methods that combine a dramatic change in diet with exercise and, plus minus statins that can then result in something like, measured angiographic improvements of, up to 7% in a year, let's say. They're still modest, but that combination therapy has been the only thing that's been shown to actually reverse the stenosis and coronary artery disease.
Coming from a big picture, sort of a 30,000 foot view meta level of all of this, and looking at the Western medical paradigm as, as you said, not really incorporating this concept of salugenesis and more operating from the frame of trying to look at every individual disease and do research to uncover the specific physiological mechanisms, biochemical pathways that are abnormal or pathological that are then framed as driving the disease process. So if you have depression, then it's because of a serotonin deficiency in your brain. And if you have atherosclerosis, it's because you've got this too much oxidized LDL entering the blood vessel wall. And if you've got high blood pressure, then we're going to use a drug that interrupts the way your kidney regulates water and electrolytes, or relaxes the blood vessel walls to sort of interrupt what the body is doing to change it. How might we start, again, from a meta level, without getting too specific on the diseases, how might we think differently if we are incorporating the concept of salugenesis and maybe having more respect for sort of this innate capacity of the body to heal itself?
Well, a lot. So we think of this as, a lot of this, it requires getting out of the way of this natural process of healing. Okay, relieving the blocks, and then taking advantage of some of the persistent danger signaling pathways that we can regulate, and one of those ends up being one of the most ancient danger signals is the release of extracellular ATP. And it turns out that once the ATP inside the cell is a good thing, it's an energy carrier. ATP outside the cell is a damage-associated molecular pattern or damp that actually binds to, you know, over a dozen different what are called purinergic receptors, and sends the signal of danger. And so what we have found in experimental work is that we can send the signal of safety by using drugs that actually compete with extracellular ATP, and gradually the system begins to right itself. And we have a small clinical trial in autism where we used a drug to compete with that extracellular ATP. The results were dramatic. We had children that spoke the first sentences in their life, had dramatic improvements in school performance and many other aspects of their life that that helped them to be more social with family members and begin to kind of break out from behind the veil that holds back a lot of children with autism. So anyway, this is a, without getting, too far along on that, we think that, that there are some very ancient signals that can get stuck and that we can help by removing those signals. But this is going to be a multi-pronged approach. It's not going to be one thing that is going to solve chronic illness, but I think that unless we begin to look in a different, at the end I just said that unless we begin to study the problem with a different lens, we're not going to be able to find the solutions that we need.
With that in mind, I know one of the things that we share is the importance of seeing health, human health, through an evolutionary lens, and the importance of evolutionary biology in looking at human health and disease. Can you talk about why you feel that's important?
Sure. A scientist named Theodosius Dobzhansky once famously said that nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. And we are all, we are all just biological beings that have received our genes from our ancestors. Another quote that helps me understand, why the body places such a high premium on defense and healing is one by John Dryden, who once said, "Self-defense is nature's oldest law." So no organism can survive unless it can defend itself from danger. And I combine these ideas in an observation that can be put together in a sentence, that without healing, multicellular life on Earth would not exist. And without healing, one injury predisposes to another, leading to disability, chronic disease, accelerated aging, and death. So we are, we're all descended from ancestors who survived each infection, plague, famine, war, and other injuries until at least the birth of their first child. Okay. And that's our inherited genetic legacy that we're born with. And so the problem that we have now is the world is changing and those genes are not enough. We are encountering factors that were never encountered by our ancestors. And these new factors press our DNA to its limits. This mismatch between the current environment and our genes is an ecogenetic mismatch that leads to disease and the susceptibility to chronic illness. So, we can't change our genes, but we can change environmental factors and behaviors that lead to disease and that can be preventing recovery. So, our metabolism or our chemistry measured in the blood is, you could imagine a drop of blood as containing the chemical conversations of all the human cells and all the bacterial cells in our body. And that real-time you know, chemistry is the real-time interaction of our genes in the environment. And so that's why our work in metabolomics has been such a powerful tool to help us understand hidden connections between diseases.
I know that we have to wrap up here. I want to ask you, based on in this model, which you've been developing for over a decade now, and all the insights you've gleaned from metabolomics research into these various diseases and how the cell danger response operates, and how the cell eugenesis mechanisms operate, and what sort of keeps them stuck, what insights would you share with people sort of on a practical level, if you want to go there, or how would you want to re-envision how medical research is done to treat diseases? What insights can you offer people to get well? How should we be thinking about getting well from these different chronic disease states based on the insights from your model?
So, you know, this model does not overturn the pathogenesis model. It just adds to it. And on the one hand, you know, master clinicians, you know, already have in mind, you know, that a framework for treating chronic illness that involves removing the trigger, support the weak points, for example, cast a broken leg, support the healing process, and remove any factors or infections that that impede healing. And then once the initial, you know, healing is complete and the cast is off, then gradually reintroduce the cardinal elements of health and safety to consolidate that message of safety, and that to shift body metabolism away from defense and toward, you know, toward recovery. And so, you know, that, I mean, we already know, and people have used the basics of good nutrition, restorative sleep, wakeful activity, toxin removal, nature connection, prosocial behaviors, but we have precious few other arrows in the medical quiver for chronic illness. And that's because I think that most of the current arrows were designed to hit different targets. Okay. And so, you know, I believe that, you know, things like anti-purinergic therapy, Pnexin channel blockers, a variety of devices, including transcranial magnetic stimulation, transcranial biomodulation, mindfulness meditation, a variety of behavioral interventions will all be synergistic. And I think, you know, we just need good clinical trials to be able to test, you know, new treatments and devices alone and in combination, because unless something is proven in, you know, a well-designed randomized clinical trial, it will not become a new foundation for medical education. It won't be, become part of the academic medical, you know, a base of knowledge from which, you know, new treatments, you know, can be born. So I'm very enthusiastic about a number of, you know, new therapies that are designed to get at the dynamics of the healing process and to remove the blocks. But there will be many other people, you know, more clever than me, that will come up with new ways to unblock the healing process and to, you know, restore, vibrant health.
I have one last question for you. One of my personal curiosities, one of my big areas of interest is hormetic stress. And I noticed that was not on your list of, as you describe them, the arrows in the medical quiver. And I'm wondering, you know, as you're in your model, you have this kind of
model of getting stuck in the cell danger response, getting stuck in, you know, something's blocking the healing cycle, and this sort of state of chronic danger signaling is getting preserved. Do you see a role for perturbations of that system via hormetic stressors, like, let's say, physical activity, but heat, cold, fasting, breath holding practices, things of that nature, in creating slight perturbations where you sort of push the system a bit further, very counterintuitively, instead of removing the stress load, you're pushing the system acutely, transiently, slightly further into the state of stress, where it might be able to better sense that it's out of balance and return itself to a proper healing cycle. Does that make sense to you or not?
Yes, we just have to be careful in the, you know, in selecting the particular stresses that can, you know, that would not be damaging to a person in their particular, you know, a particular situation and the stage at which their, you know, their disease is. But you know, you need the CDR for hormesis. It is, you know, it is necessary to create the metabolic memories that you know, stay with the body and cells after you've recovered. So it's critical, and it's you know, it's possible that selecting the right hormetic challenges could be a part of this approach to unblocking the healing response and to allow more cells to get back to vibrant health.
Dr. Naviau, thank you so much for doing this. Are there any final words that you want to leave people with?
Yeah, I'll just say that I believe that salogenesis-based therapies will begin where pathogenesis-based therapies end. And I really, you know, hope that there'll be, you know, many physicians and healthcare workers and medical students around the world that, you know, begin thinking deeply about the process of healing.
Right. That's it. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Hey there, this is Ari again. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, if you found it valuable, please share it with your friends, share it with your family. Help me get the word out there. Also, if you're on YouTube, make sure to hit the subscribe button and hit that little bell to get notifications every time we release a new video or new episode of the podcast. And if you're listening to this, make sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. Thanks so much for supporting my work at the Energy Blueprint. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I will see you in the next.